One of the great post-war achievements was the establishment of the welfare state. And in a document rather dryly entitled Social Services and Allied Services, Sir William Beveridge set out the vision for the welfare state. And it was a plan for a new society after the war. It was, he said, it was not about giving everybody something for nothing. It involved contributions in return for benefits. And even though victory was hardly assured, it was anticipated. And the victory brought about a new opportunity for a changed society, a different order of things. And he said, the purpose of victory is to live in a better world than the old world. At the heart of the report, we find a remarkable Bunyan-esque sentence recognizing that social security is itself part of something more complete and strategic. And this is what he says. It is one part only of an attack upon five giant evils, upon physical want, which is directly concerned, upon disease, which often causes that want and brings many other troubles in its train, upon ignorance, which no democracy can afford among its citizens, upon squalor, and upon the idleness which destroys wealth and corrupts men. Of course, there are also very good economic and social reasons alone for waging war on these five giant evils. But as you can see from Beveridge's language, it's more than pure utilitarianism. There is a moral imperative here, and it's the vision that informs it and takes us beyond the merely political and the convenient. And it's that moral vision, I want to suggest, which underlies the health service that we now have. Because health itself is more than just the physical and mental well-being of the individual. The provision of healthcare is, I think, one of the most significant indicators of a nation's moral commitment to its citizens. And it exposes its deepest values, especially its vision and understanding of the human person. Now, we've rightly been celebrating the NHS at this time and the achievement of Beveridge and the Beveridge reform. And it is a great achievement, and it's one of which we should be rightly proud. But it's interesting, too, that it also comes at a time, our celebration also comes at a time of anxiety, because the whole debate becomes one about economics and the sustainability of the high-class healthcare system that we have. Now, this is understandable, but it's also interesting that buried in all the talk about economics and the statistics and the political questions is the moral question again, because Niall Dixon, the new director of the King's Fund, says even the whole debate about how we should finance the healthcare system that we have, he says it's really a moral decision, whether as a society we decide we want to stay in all this together or we want to start going our separate ways. This afternoon, I want to argue that it is ultimately a moral question, and that's why it's important to have faith in health. But it's one that can be easily eroded if it remains purely economic. And it's one that is determined by fears and anxieties about health and access to treatment. And I want to argue that it's part of the church's role, part of our role, to clarify the issues, to point to the values that are at stake. And I want to further argue that faith in health is more than just the presence of Christians and Catholics in healthcare. It's also about the particular perspective that faith brings to healthcare, which is vital to it. And I would argue that it's part of this its presence in healthcare that delivers a constancy of vision and a constancy of value, which answers the questions that Baroness Cumberledge was talking about this morning on trust. Because if we have a healthcare that has these values secure at its center, then it is one that can be trusted by the people that come in need. But I want to argue this by arguing first that in fact there is a problem with our whole concept of health. And in fact, the way in which we think about it is actually about the production of unhealth. So how health makes us unhealthy. Health is one of the most desired things, and it's a good which we all seek to possess. And it's an important good, and it's one that we rightly want to secure personally and also for the community. But what has happened to health, inverted commas? We've become enormously health conscious. I understand that there's a good side to this, and we want more information about health and illness and disease, and we also want more resources at our disposal. We want more control over our lifestyle. And this puts an enormous expectation upon medicine and medical technology to make us healthy and to keep us healthy. We also have moved to a highly individualized sense of health. It's good to have an awareness of my responsibility to keep myself healthy. But if it becomes too personalized and too individual, then in fact what happens is we begin to sever health from the community, because the relationship then becomes one of the customer and the provider. And the expectation then is one of exchange. It's an exchange relationship. And what comes into play is power, especially my power to purchase or to buy or to control the treatment, the health that I seek. Health becomes an end in itself. And what it means to have health or to be healthy also shifts, because it's not just about the prevention of disease. Health itself becomes a social icon. So health and medicine sit within the ideological framework of our society. I must be healthy. Health and the image of health gets me certain goods. It gets me a certain status. It gets me a certain cash in society. And there's a whole playoff that goes on with that. So that the whole point then of science and medicine and scientific technology is a certain optimism that it can deliver us from sickness and death and the limitations placed upon us by our bodies. An interesting article by Daniel Callahan called Death and the Research Imperative in the New England Journal of Medicine has this to say. He says, nobody speaks openly about immortality as the aim of medicine, but medicine's research imperative is, to quote him, death is a series of preventable diseases. From this perspective, the researcher is like the sharpshooter who will pick off the enemy one by one. Cancer, then heart disease, then diabetes, then AIDS, then Alzheimer's disease, and so on. So, in another way, health becomes the symbol of our triumph over nature, our final freedom from its laws, but also a good possessed in itself, and therefore a real moral achievement. In this sense, then, health becomes a commodity, and it becomes subject to the market. Now, the problem with markets is that they also need consumers. So what happens is, everywhere you find a market, the market has to produce a consumer. It makes me a consumer. I don't know if you're as troubled by spam as I am. I want to confess to that disease immediately and hope that you can find a cure for me. If you read the spam, you're given an extraordinary image of what you're not. I would have a phenomenal body if I bought all the things that were on offer. I wouldn't recognize myself. And that might be an advantage, might also be a disadvantage. But I could guarantee that if I were to take all the pills and all the lotions and all the mixtures that are offered to gain this health, this super health, then I would probably die of toxic poisoning. So there's a whole image construction that's going on here to make me a consumer. Now, part of the way in which you generate consumers is you present them with a desire that is always going to be unattainable because you need to have more. The other thing you do is you actually produce anxiety, because you need to generate anxiety so that you can then say, I can relieve your anxiety. So in a curious way, in our search for health, we produce a high anxiety culture about health. And that generates its own social, political, and economic pressure to consume, because consumption, health becomes necessary to make me autonomous and to achieve success. We generate an anxiety about the absence of health. So I must have perfect cholesterol levels, even though I'm Irish. I must have a perfect BP count. And any lapse of memory is incipient Alzheimer's, and so I live with fear, and I look for the cure. So we have a constantly expanding economy of health, which requires this constantly expanding market. We produce a consumer who is perpetually unsatisfied, restless, anxious, and bored. We generate what one commentator has called an endlessly wanting culture. This process of commodification has another impact. It is about the disembedding of the economic relationships across space and time. What does that mean? We all practice it. If I want to buy something, I don't go to the local store usually. What I do is I go on the web, I go on the net, and I can do it very easily with great facility. And what that means is these relationships become depersonalized. So we don't need a personal relationship with the supplier. We no longer have a personal history. We no longer need to ask who at the other end. All we need to know is that we get the commodity that we want. The economic relationship of exchange becomes the real relationship. Now, I want to suggest to you that, in fact, that becomes a dominant, if you like, relationship within the healthcare system if we're not careful about it. So what we have is a deep, all the talk about the personalized care is in fact another way of embedding an impersonal care, because we're in a market exchange relationship. Now this of course has been a sort of hasty sketch of a problem. It obviously, we have forces of resistance against that, and I think most of us in fact would want to resist that. But we equally understand when we become placed in those sorts of relationships. It's more obvious in cultures like the USA, but I'm suggesting that it's here for us too, and that we live it, wrapped up also in these values of personalized health and patient care. So where do we go with that? You'll see that effectively and subtly, if we get into those sorts of relationships with health as a commodity, with a generation of expectation and anxiety, then in fact the very values that we want to preserve that make this system so extraordinary that we have, in fact get undermined. Because we're dealing always with expectations that can't be met. And the fundamental relationships that are generated actually count against a deeply personalized, generous and caring system.